Welcome to part two of episode 127 on John Dewey, Experience in Nature. So let's recap where we are right now. We've jumped around a lot, but we've got all the major points out there. We've said what bridging the bifurcation of nature amounts to. No, that's a terrible way of putting it. That's not even his term.
He uses something similar. I mean, I know that's Whitehead's term. It's the fallacy of selective emphasis.
Well, yeah, that leads to it. But the idea that experience is double-barreled, that it, mm-hmm. quote, recognizes no division between act and material, subject and object, but contains them both in an unanalyzed totality. So that's kind of an assumption, though, right? That's the starting point. Yeah. And his justification for that is that it's what science assumes, and that practice starts and ends in experience, scientific practice, which is undeniably true. So
yeah. And these chapters are in some ways a criticism of philosophy, or philosophy so far, which is, I guess, always what philosophers do. And this point of selective emphasis, he says, selective emphasis, choice is inevitable whenever reflection occurs. This is not an evil. Deception comes only when the presence and operation of choice is concealed, disguised, denied. Empirical method finds and points to the operation of choice as it does to any other event. Thus, it protects us from conversion of eventual functions into antecedent existence, a conversion that may be said to be the philosophic fallacy, whether it be performed on behalf of mathematical subsistences, aesthetic essences, the purely physical order of nature, or God.
So, yeah, the conversion of the eventual into the antecedent.
Yes.
Is this conversion of what I called epistemic values of unity and stability, the things we desire out of inquiry, into something that is antecedently there in nature and that we just have to grasp.
Yeah. And this goes to the struggle with refusing to talk about things as being real, because that process that West has referred to ends up being what we mean by the real, those things that are actually there. And Dewey really just wants to not worry about that.
Well, he talks a lot about this version of knowing that he rejects, which is this idea that we simply have a grasp. We find a good. Yeah, page 86. For knowledge is a memorandum of conditions of their appearances. There's nothing behind this veil of sensation or something like that. Knowledge is a memorandum of condition of their appearances, concern that is with sequences, coexistence, relations. I'd mentioned before, the knowledge is always pointed towards the relational. It's never pointed towards a reified substance-like thing. Immediate things may be pointed to by words, but not described or defined. And I assume he means these immediate, ineffable experiences here. Description, when it occurs, is but part of a circuitous method of pointing or denoting. Sounds like something we've just been reading about. Index to a starting point and road, which if taken, may lead to a direct, ineffable presence. So then modern thinkers get it wrong.
Well, I like the next part of the quote that you were reading.
Go ahead. Go for it.
Modern thinkers, influenced by the notion that knowledge is the only mode of experience that grasps things, assuming the ubiquity of cognition and noting that immediacy or qualitative existence has no place in authentic science, have asserted that qualities are always and only states of consciousness. It is a reasonable belief that there would be no such thing as consciousness if events did not have a phase of brute and unconditioned isness, of being just what they irreducibly are.
Yeah. So the other part of this is on 88, where you talk about cognition or knowing as grasping essences, or elsewhere he's going to talk about treating scientific models as if they are, instead of the atom being this thing that we develop to instrumentally manage experiences, we reify that and think of that, oh, it was there all along, and then we grasped it. We metaphysicalize it. So that's what he objects to as a model of knowing.
Yeah. He thinks that when you do that, you close off the possibility of knowing at all. So it does two things. One is that if it were even true, then there would be nothing left to be known or nothing left to be figured out, because everything would be static, which I'm not sure about that part of his argument. But then it's also that the way in which elements are part of wholes, but not wholly by themselves, is the way in which you are able to get relations at all. So at the end of the paragraph that we were just reading from, to dispose of things in which relations terminate by calling them elements is to discourse within a relational logical scheme. Only if elements are more than just elements in a whole, Only if they have something qualitatively their own can a relational system be prevented from complete collapse. So even these elements that we have and call them individual elements, they have to point outside themselves. Otherwise, you can't have a relation.
Yeah.
So this talk of historicism, just looking in the preface on the first page, the course of the ideas is determined by a desire to apply in the more general realm of philosophy the thought which is effective in dealing with any and every genuine question. The constant task of such thought is to establish working connections between old and new subject matters. We cannot lay hold of the new, we cannot even keep it before our minds, much less understand it, save by the use of ideas and knowledge we already possess. So not only does this bring to mind the overall historical take that you were just showing how it's applied in understanding the things of science or perceiving anything at all is to get some idea of its history. But I was brought to mind our Gadamer's hermeneutics discussion that you only know things, I guess it's an age-old problem of knowledge, right? How do you learn anything new? You have to have the tools to understand something in order to understand it. But if you have the tools to understand it already, well, why didn't you already understand it? That's kind of a bastardization of, mm-hmm. of one way of putting one of the Platonic things. And so that's the dynamic that's involved in any kind of knowledge, and the historical progression of knowledge is by using what you've got and trying to reconcile it with some new piece of data, and then the two inform each other. So what you've already got on your plate informs how you understand the new thing, and then the new thing in turn ricochets back and refines your understanding of the old thing. We already used the table as an example of just our interaction with everything involves an ongoing bringing our own expectations and experiences and then contemplating the thing itself, that new experience, and having those feed each other in a historical process. And that's what getting knowledge, that's what science is all about. It's not just a matter of mutely, like an infant, pushing and pulling at a table or something, but a matter of bringing to bear these large-scale scientific concepts and things and numerous connections, not just this object with an experiment that I happen to do on it right now.
In the preface, I have a number of places where I just wrote yes in the side of the book. His experience is not a veil that shuts man off from nature. Is it a means of penetrating continually further into the heart of nature? There is, yep. in the character of human experience, no index hand pointing to agnostic conclusions, but rather a growing, progressive self-disclosure of nature itself. The failures of philosophy have come from lack of confidence in the directive powers that inhere in experience, if men have but the wit and courage to follow them.
Yeah, which I found a little weird that he's ultimately saying that the failures of philosophy are from a lack of confidence. We have not had the sufficient courage, that element is in there.
Well, it's the lack of confidence and experience. To me, I mean, this particular quote was directed at, I take sort of one of the two big prongs that he's assailing in the history of philosophy, one that denies the truth of experience and amounts to saying that our everyday experience is lying to us and what is really true lies beyond and outside of our experience. And that's what that's directed at. Whereas he's saying throughout that our experience and our intellects will sort that out. And it's not that our experience is lying to us, it's that we have to figure out what our experience is of.
Well, and bringing to mind, you know, I was saying Augustine could be his whipping boy in this book, and think about sort of Nietzsche's take on Augustine. Nietzsche would very much assail Augustine and Schopenhauer and, you know, for being cowardly, for the fact that Augustine says, oh, you can't rely on those things that are going to just disappear. Everybody's going to die. Yep. It's all going to fade. We have to retreat somehow and subvert the self to contemplating the eternal, to contemplating God. That's a cowardly way out. That this is almost going right back to our Camus episode at the very beginning. Like, confront the, well, Dewey's not going to say it's the absurdity of experience, but the brute fact, the brute existence as it is given to us.
And it can't be any accident that some of his language, especially regarding hazard and precariousness of life, is at least imbued with the fact that this is written at the closing of World War I in 1919, right?
25, I thought.
25, okay. So reflecting on the ends of World War I. mean, not that he ever mentions it in particular, but the characteristic of life and living is being not just about the good things, but about the bad things, and that our thinking and rational activity is about dealing with the precariousness of life.
Well, and another point that I think he thinks you need courage and confidence and experience to, you know, one of the big points of this book, according to the preface, is he thinks his method can be genuinely naturalistic, yet maintain cherished values, provided they are critically clarified and reinforced. So one of the things he rips on in here is materialism and the idea, you know, that one of the things that comes with this bifurcation of nature is that you take all values and put them only in the head. They become merely subjective things, because how could they exist out in the physical world if what's outside of us is something, at least one of the ways of being a naturalist is just to be a straight up physicalist. And so it just creates a problem. Yeah.
This is actually, so he, after he talks about this idea that Greek aesthetic idea of knowledge is these final ends, then you get this sort of rebellion against ends with the scientific revolution. And there are no longer ends in nature. They're only in the head. And then what explains, you know, your subjective experiences are the mechanical relations in this other realm, you know, so atoms and things like that are, you know, corpuscles of light and so on. So that's just as bad for him as the Greek account, because we lose qualitative immediacy, he says, as part of the world. Qualitative immediacy just becomes a part of personal consciousness.
I mean, should we jump to try to talk about ends? That seems like one of the difficult issues that we haven't taken on yet.
Yeah. Let's try it.
So that's in chapter 3.
So this is actually, yeah, so right after he talks about the sense in which the scientific revolution banned talk of ends on 96, this is where Dewey is going to say, all right, I'm going to retrieve some of the ancient account. It's just that the aesthetic is going to remain in immediate experience. The aesthetic is not going to be conflated with the rational object of knowledge, the metaphysical object of our knowledge.
Could we just say a little more, since people don't have Plato maybe right ready to mind, what that amounts to?
And in fact, he goes through both Plato and Aristotle here in the section of the kind of his genealogy.
So basically the idea is that the Greeks conflated the appreciation of beauty and the aesthetic with the rational, so that what you get with, say, a Platonic metaphysics, where these forms, you know, the idea that the fundamental reality of things are supposed to be these Platonic forms and the contemplation of these things, he sees that as a sort of aesthetic type of engagement, because it's simply contemplative. It's more appreciative than it is anything else, right? It's not any sort of practical activity in this world.
It becomes a theology.
And in Aristotle, it becomes, even though that, so the organism, for instance, is sort of modeled on the idea of labor, and its work is towards the end of being itself, being what it is.
He goes through the classical case, if, you know, essentially Plato and Aristotle, and then the rebellion against it in the birth of the new science, and then wants to sort of split it down the middle.
So in 90 is where it begins with the account of the ancient Greeks. So basically the idea is that Greek art and philosophy amounted to a joy in the unchanging. So here's a quote. Form was the first and last word of philosophy because it had been that of art. Form is change arrested in a prerogative object. It conveys a sense of the imperishable and timeless, although the material in which it is exemplified is subject to decay and contingency.
Well, I have another quote picked out on that same page. Objects are actually aesthetic when they turn hazard and defeat to an issue which is above and beyond trouble and vicissitude.
Right.
Festal celebration and consummatory delight. Which this reminded me very much of our Nietzsche Birth of Tragedy episode, that he had a very similar take on the Greeks, that the Greeks acknowledged the strife and the trouble and kind of what gives interest and depth to their art in some ways makes it problematic, depending on what exact era of Greece you're talking about, is that they papered over it, that, you know, what it is in their contemplation of beauty is a, well, it could be a defeat, but it could just be an ignoring of this underlying strife, but it's certainly informed by that. It's not innocent.
Yeah, I was misrepresenting this sort of by focusing on the beauty part, when really it's about this grasping at the stability for the sake of avoiding the precariousness of the world and the precariousness of scientific inquiry.
And right in here, and then again at the end of chapter 4, I think, a couple times in the book, he makes the connection specifically to slavery and the division of labor.
Well, he does that here, right? And on page 91, yeah.
Yeah, just like, you know, in our Hannah Arendt discussion, she was kind of rejoicing the fact yeah. that some portion of the populace was able to not worry about the necessities of life, and so they could do this kind of stuff. Well, Dewey has a similar appreciation for the fact that philosophy was possible, and but thinks, of course, the goal of a democratic society should be spread to everybody, that contemplation is one of the main goods that humans can get into. And it's too bad that in the past, it was limited to a few mooters at the top of the food chain.
Well, yeah, Dewey is saying that the model of science for the ancient Greeks is predicated on the idea of a leisure class that just contemplates things instead of actually doing any work. And work is bad and lower. And so you wouldn't think of science as involving work.
Right. So Dewey does not have as one of his options Hannah Arendt's idea of, well, it's not contemplation, but it's not labor either. It's action in this political sense, whatever that meant. Yeah, you know, right, and we didn't know what that meant either. And so it's not surprising that Dewey does not have that on his table. But just the fact that he thinks it actually influenced this division, actually influenced and corrupted the philosophy itself. The fact that it was so, you know, it forgot its origins in practical activity. It's practical activity that sort of figures out all this stuff. And he talks about artisans, how Plato's talk of forms, Aristotle's talk of forms, and Aristotle's talk of the four types of causation. These all actually came straight out, he says, of the experience of artisans in crafting stuff. You know, when you're making a statue, there's the final cause. In other words, what do you want the statue to look like? There's the material cause. What are you going to make it out of? There's the form. There's what is your ultimate purpose in making it? That all these things gave rise to the notions of, that Plato and Aristotle then detached from their sources, were ungrateful to their sources.
Well, on 92, though, he says Aristotle gives this account, right? Yeah, they detach it, but so Aristotle made nature a skilled laborer that achieves ends, basically. Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting paradox where the model is sort of labor-related, but what you get in the end are these fixed ends that are sort of antecedent and already accomplished. The labor, in a sense, is already accomplished. And in some other stable realm, and then the flux realm moves in the direction of those ends somehow.
Dewey says, philosophers were not the authors of an identification of objects informed with ideal order in proportion with a final and arresting outcome of processes of antecedent change. That identification was at least implicit in the operation of artisans. Nor were the philosophers the originators of the idea that mental appropriation of some objects is intrinsically a state of elevated satisfaction. That fact was given to them in the aesthetic culture of their civilization. What the philosophers are responsible for is a peculiar one-sided interpretation of these empirical facts, an interpretation, however, which has its roots in features of Greek culture. This is the political or social structure that you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
I thought that part of it was linked to their understanding, according to Dewey, their understanding of the gods, that the gods would never labor and that, you know, the higher classes would be more godlike and therefore more about the eternal and the unchanging and the permanent. So you have this problem of ideal forms of them that are always persisting. Then you have all the machinations to try to make our own experience of the world reflective of those forms, you know, the cave in Plato or the teleology or the process of becoming more and more perfect in Aristotle.
Right. We're bringing this up in the context of ends. And so the thing that he's accusing the Greeks of is illicitly looking at Plato has this in that he says everybody's inclined toward the good, or at least what they think the good is. That's just the natural way we drift. But Aristotle makes this really explicit, even with all the things in nature, so that a rock falls because it is made of earth, and earth has as its natural end, really, it's good to go down, to go toward the earth. And so everything has its natural end. The thing that it will, in the absence of something stopping it, pursue is its good. And we've made a lot of use of that when thinking about ethics. It seems one of the only sensible ways to think about ethics is to think about the way in which, not that humans actually behave in all circumstances, but that if given a good upbringing, it's hard to use not words, use the word good in it, but what they will tend to as a matter of their nature, unless you are an Augustinian pessimist about human sin, then it seems a promising way to talk about the good. And I think that maybe we don't know because we didn't read the ethics part of this, that Dewey would be okay ultimately with thinking about values in such terms, but clearly to apply it across the board to science and think about why stones move is having anything to do with their good. It was just illicit. And so,
yeah, what he says here is that the problem is the idea that these unchanging ends are the objects of knowledge. To understand something, you have to understand these unchanging ends. So they become these objects of immediate contemplation.
Yeah.
And the main problem with that is there's no model of experimental inquiry and reflection there. Your science can't involve any laboriousness or action or getting down into the muck of things and experimenting.
Yeah. In the paragraph right after the one we were reading, experience afforded no model for a conception of experimental inquiry and of reflection efficacious in action. In consequence, the sole notability, intelligibility of nature was conceived to reside in objects that were ends, since they set limits to change.
So even though we didn't read Dewey on ethics, we've read enough naturalistic ethicists that we can come up with probably a version of this that will work for that. And it's certainly not that there's an ideal, what would Jesus do? There's not an ideal human that it's our job to conform to that imagined ideal's attributes, that's what ethics is about. It has to be something more organic, having to do with what you are now and the ways in which you are growing and interacting with your environment and becoming enriched in all these different ways. So you could even say Nietzsche has a version of ethics that sounds very much like that.
Yeah.
So then we move bottom of page 94 and 95 to this. The scientific revolution does away with that, which in a way is a good thing, right? The ends are no longer the proper objects of science. But the problem is the ends get relegated to the subjective, to personal experience. And that gives us the whole appearance, reality distinction and subject-object distinction. That's a no-no that he wants to avoid. And that's why he's going to retrieve some of the ancient account, restore some of this aesthetic, but restore it to the non-cognitive, to the immediately grasped, the final, what he calls the final. And, you know, again, this is a place on page 96 where he's reasserting what we've already said, which is that our evaluative experiences are just as real as color and smell and so on and so forth.
Well, and part of that is the problem of 17th century science in going too far is it flattens everything. And part of recovering ends is recovering events and recovering the individuality of things. So part of it is the subjective experience, but that part of ends, which is true about individual events.
So there's a great quote on 96. Is there any ingredient of truth in ancient metaphysics that may be extracted and reaffirmed? Empirically, the existence of objects of direct grasp, possession, use, and enjoyment cannot be denied. Empirically, things are poignant, tragic, beautiful, humorous, settled, disturbed, comfortable, annoying, barren, harsh, consoling, splendid, fearful. As such, immediately and in their own right, and behalf. So I know we've belabored this point, but I just liked his descriptions of those. And also, I wanted to reemphasize this point that he's retrieving some of the aesthetic account, some of the ancient account with the aesthetics, but he wants to disconnect it from knowledge and set us up instead with this non-cognitive, non-knowledge-based immediate grasp of these primary experiences, which are not knowledge. He says that many times. Our relationship to primary experience is not knowledge. Our relationships to the sequences, the relations, that's knowledge.
Well, so this is what is confusing about his use of ends. So the sentence right after what you read is, if we take advantage of the word aesthetic in a wider sense than that of application to the beautiful and ugly, aesthetic quality, immediate, final, or self-enclosed, indubitably characterizes natural situations as they empirically occur. Mm-hmm. So it seems like we've got three different use of the word end here, two or three. One of them was the teleological is something that is being aimed at. That's the whole point.
But it's not a person who's aiming at it. It's
right.
Yeah. Nature is aiming at it somehow.
Right. And that seems to be what I wasn't sure if he wanted to keep this or not. Natural teleology.
No, he's going to reject that because that's...
Oh, yeah. Okay. So he's in favor of end being the outcome of a series of events. In that sense, it's an ending. And then the way he's saying it's aesthetically, it's immediate, final, or self-enclosed. In other words, it's an end in that it is... He even uses the word self-enclosed here.
This is the very beginning of his account. So we could work through it because it is complicated.
Okay. It's funny that he uses the word self-enclosed here, Wes, that we were objecting to you saying that these primary experience are self-contained, non-referenced to anything else or something like this, when the word self-enclosed seems to mean exactly that. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, and then the very next paragraph from what you were reading, Mark, is he makes an aside about how troublesome it is to deal with this issue of ends. And then the next paragraph, he tries to begin to make sense of ends by linking them with beginnings. And this is, to me, part of his really trying to emphasize the event structure of his metaphysics. Mm-hmm. The genuine implications of natural ends may be brought out by considering beginnings instead of endings. To insist that nature is an affair of beginnings is to assert that there is no one single and at once beginning of everything. But it is another way of saying that nature is an affair of affairs, wherein each one, no matter how linked up it may be with others, has its own quality. So he wants to essentially say, well, every ending is a beginning and every beginning is an ending. And it'll make more sense what I'm saying about endings if you just also think about them as beginnings. I guess that's one part of it. So that tries to dull the effect of it being the one true thing to which something is pointing, rather than having it more or less be along a causal process, an evolutionary end, as opposed to a one true end.
Part of what he's doing on this page is he wants to get at some more neutral conception of end,
yes,
exactly, than the ancient Greek account. Although, by going through all his adjectives of poignant, tragic, beautiful, it is a little confusing now, because he's talking about ends and beginnings merely as endings and beginnings instead of this thing that's tended towards.
Yeah,
but clearly they both have reference to an observer, it seems.
Well, not yet. I mean, he wants to, now we're talking about it in the wrong way, if we talk about an observer versus the...
That's what I don't understand about the way that Dylan just described it. If because we were saying that anything that is the subject of a direct perception, you know, that's primary experience, is final, is ultimate in itself. It's not merely, which I understand negatively what that means. In other words, it's not a mere appearance and the ultimate thing is something that's underneath. And, you know, that's the bifurcation of nature thing. That would be a problem. But what does it mean?
But it's also final, sorry, just in the sense that what it is doesn't depend on anything else. So it is, any quality as such is final. It is at once initial and terminal, just what it is as it exists.
It's at once initial and terminal. So it's not that it's presenting itself as the outcome of a historical progression.
Right.
Yes. And that's why he has, when he wants to start thinking about ends by thinking about beginnings, and says that, saying that nature is an affair of affairs, he's really emphasizing this event structure. And he'll go on to even clarify, typically when we speak of ends, he says that we end up talking about only ends that are good, that we're happy with, you know, and that the fact is that things may have ends that aren't good. Diseases and accidents and wars, lies and errors, and talking about them as beginnings, but in the end, they're going to be ends. So he says, clearly the fact and idea of beginning is neutral, not eulogistic, temporal, not absolute. And he wants to imbue ends with that idea.
This is what's so confusing, because, yeah, now it looks like this neutral idea has come on the scene, where it's just these beginnings or endings of causal sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, we had this concept of the finality of immediate experience and the fact that it could be poignant, tragic, so on and so forth, which seems a very unneutral.
I guess the crux is that there are two ways that human motivations could come in here. And one of them is a good way and is an acceptable way. And one of them is a bad way. If the bad way, clearly he's pointing out, is what you just said, that if you only point out as an end something that was actually desirable, well, that's sort of leaving out half the picture. That really, if you're just looking at temporal sequences, you got to see, how did this resolve? How did this resolve? Well, it resolved in that the patient died. That is an ending, and you better admit that. So you don't want your human desire to see things work out well sort of let you ignore that somehow.
Yeah, you're right. That's what he means by neutrality, is that it could just be good or bad.
Right. He says, okay. I mean, just the fact that there's a problem of evil in philosophy, he mentioned somewhere that, well, why isn't there a problem of good, too? Isn't that just as weird? But instead, our predispositions make us sort of count only the good. Again, think about Augustine here. Only the good is real, and that evil is somehow not It's just a derivative. It's just lack of human understanding of something. It's not really an ending at all. Because really the end is that the guy went to heaven or something. Like it's the good part is maybe out of our view. But on the other hand, just talking about a causal sequence as having a beginning and an ending is clearly, I think this would be admissible to Dewey to say, has to do with human interests. Like what we count as, just like what we are picking out a table as a distinct object, as opposed to the air around the table being part of that object. What makes us count something as a sequence, as an affair, having this beginning and this ending, has something to do with our makeup as people. Maybe not my immediate desire to see something happen, but something about our makeup as expecting beings and our interests in that broader sense, right? It's a choice, the way he puts it. It's an abstraction, calling this an affair, this temporal sequence in this location from A to B. That is a choice that we have abstracted that and are calling that an affair and this part the beginning and this part the ending. But it's not an arbitrary one, just like all these other choices. It's driven by pragmatic concerns in some broad sense.
Well, okay, yeah, we've jumped ahead. What you're talking about is on page 101, where, so he says...
So still this chapter. It's just a really long chapter.
No, it's just the whole where he tries to collapse. The next step is collapsing efficient and final causation. Says we can't distinguish them, which is an interesting discussion in his own right. But where he gets us to is this idea that intent and import are part of every field of consciousness, but not by virtue of a separate mental. Should be on page 101. Sorry, 100. Let's look over field of consciousness if you want to.
Well, and on 101, you're getting into this section on static versus dynamic.
Yeah, the static versus the point of that is he wants to say final causes don't tug and efficient causes don't push, because that implies this sort of transcendent thing. So that's he's revising the notions of static and dynamic so that they don't include any transcendent content. Causality is just the sequential order as a whole. It's not this idea of a mystical force that's pushing things.
Yep.
Okay, so just to clarify for folks, that's what efficient cause meant, according to Aristotle, is this pushing of one thing on another. And the final cause would be sort of the model that things are trying to adhere to. And he's saying, no.
Yeah, the final cause for the tree is it's trying to be a tree. It's trying to be formally, you know, actualize this blueprint for what it is. And efficient cause is just the scientific thing of one billiard ball hitting another and that we think of as involving the forces of physics and things like that. The important part there is to subtract any transcendent content from all that and think of causality just as this sequential order, just as this sequence of events.
I mean, I don't know if you're thinking about this part, but it's at the end of this paragraph that you're in the middle of where he summarizes Greek thought and modern thought. So he says...
So I actually found it.
Okay.
So for this reason, and not because of any unique properties of a separate kind of existence called psychic or mental, every situation or field of consciousness is marked by initiation, direction or intent, and consequence or import. What is unique is not these traits, but the property of awareness or perception. So in other words, we might be aware of them, in which case that becomes our conscious intent, but the intent is there in the field of consciousness or the situation. That seems to be what he's saying here. This is page 101.
The intent is in the situation, even if nobody is paying attention to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much in line again with his saying these things that we normally call mental are not in the head.
Yeah.
They're out there. But yet he doesn't want to say it's like the ancient Greeks said that the things apart from any observers have natural aims, have final causes that are tugging them. It's the fact that he doesn't want to separate the mind from nature lets him talk in this confused way.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that gets us to this idea of the end in view
yes.
at the bottom of this page, where basically if there is consciousness involved, then the event becomes what he calls expectant or commemorative. And the terminal outcome, to use his language, that's anticipated consciously, that's the end in view. So now we have this weird distinction between the intent that's there in the situation, regardless of consciousness, which is a kind of end, I guess, and then the end in view once we've become conscious of it, where we anticipate. So I don't understand it, I admit. He does say that for the Greeks, ends are forms, and for the moderns, they're these private things. For him, they are the projections of possible consequences, ends in view, which again seems to be you take perception as a natural fact. You look at these dyads from on high, the subject-object dyad, and I don't know.
Let's stop for a minute. Wes, tell us about our sponsor, Zevia.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Zevia.
Zevia is the zero-calorie, naturally sweetened soda that's clearly different. No sugar, no calories, and no artificial sweeteners make this a cleaner, healthier soda option. Zevia is available in 15 delicious flavors like cream soda, black cherry, cola, ginger ale, and there's even a tonic water. Every flavor is zero calories. You can drink them by themselves, or they also make excellent mixers. I'm actually a big fan of Zevia, especially the root beer flavor. I started drinking it years ago when I wanted to get away from diet sodas that use artificial sweeteners. Really good, and they're not using NutraSweet or Splenda. You can find Zevia online at Amazon.com or at your local grocery or natural food store. And if you go to Zevia.com/podcast, you could win a free six-pack. That's Zevia.com/podcast.
Okay, let's just go back to 103. Primitive man, like naive common sense. This we already read.
Let's go all the way back to primitive man.
Primitive man, like naive common sense, imputes terminating qualities to nature, in which follows a sound realistic metaphysics. But it also imputes to them the property of causal determination, an imputation rejected by science. Rejection by science does not prove these qualities to be mere subjective or private appearances. It only shows that they are termini, closings of serial events. You guys understand that so far? I'm not sure I completely do. Rejection by science. Why is science rejecting?
This is just a restatement of when he says primitive man gives terminating qualities to nature. That's the, you know, it's enjoyable and that's a real thing. So, right? That's just a restatement of what he's said many times before. And then
it imputes to them the property of causal determination, which science rejects. Why does science reject causal determination in things themselves?
Naive common sense does by imputing terminating qualities to nature.
Because it means that you can become superstitious.
Gotcha. Yeah. Every sequence amounts to cause.
Yes.
That's what superstition is about. Does the next sentence make sense if we interpret it that way? Rejection by science does not prove these qualities to be mere subjective or private appearances. So if I think that the appearance of the goose caused the rain and science rejects that,
that doesn't
prove them to be subjective or private appearances. It only shows that they are termini closings of serial events. It shows that as a matter of an experience, it happened that in that experience, the rain came after the goose.
Exactly. Okay. I think that works.
Okay. Events that achieve and possess them are linked, mediatory, transitive, indicative, and the proper material of knowledge. Well, okay. So the superstitious case doesn't work here because the point is if it's proper material of knowledge is you should be able to investigate that. And does rain start every time the goose comes around? No. So that's not something that we would even call causal, even with a casual amount of investigation.
There's a process in methodology and science that would sort out that problem by, you know, demanding that these things be repeatable and in front of everybody and not private and so forth.
So I think what he's saying here is he likes natural ends and this idea of attributing these finalities, these terminating qualities to nature, as long as you don't see them as causal in any way. If something is good, that something prior to that is tending towards that good. So it is good in and of itself, but it's not that it's pulling on things towards it.
Wouldn't he purge the word good from any discussion of ends?
He's saying that they don't have to be good. They can be all kinds of, they can be bad, they can be...
Yeah, I'm going too far to say purge good from anything. He would admit that there were ends that were good and you could discuss them in that manner.
Yeah, they could be poignant, tragic, beautiful, humorous, blah,
yes,
blah, blah.
Yes, absolutely. But it's not the case that all ends are good.
Exactly.
Okay. And Mark was going to have us move to this paragraph right after the one he's working on where Dewey summarizes ends a bit.
You made me want to go back two sentences to read this in terms of final causation. So in other words, primitive man imputes terminating qualities to nature, but it also imputes to them the property of causal determination. In other words, it rains because I need it to rain, because it'll make my crops grow.
Yes.
An imputation rejected by science. Well, clearly that kind of thing is rejected by science. Rejection by science does not prove these qualities to be mere subjective or private appearances. It only shows they are termini closings of serial events. Events that achieve and possess them are linked, mediatory, transitive, indicative, and the proper material for knowledge. So I was thrown by the proper material and the for knowledge part by thinking that knowledge only knows something that actually is causal. But knowledge can know anything that is just a sequence even.
Yep.
All the causal is a sequence.
Yeah, but this saves Mark's understanding about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just that there are different kinds of sequences and science will be able to tell the difference between them.
Yes.
It's just that's part of investigating right. it, is that you can see yeah. goose does not equal rain and my desire for rain does not equal rain.
Yeah, the difference is the regularity, the yeah. repeatability. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So sequences are knowledge, right? But you could still be wrong, right?
So, it's, yes, that's the same way of saying that my illusion that the sound was in fact scary or that there's water over there when it's actually a mirage.
Yes.
We can still say the illusion itself is part of nature.
Yeah.
Even though dreamed table is not going to be in our ontology exactly, you can still talk about that occurrence.
Well, it is. It's on the same status as it's just functionally related to other appearance. I mean, that's an important point because
okay.
if you want to talk about ontology, then you have to get into this whole thing of more real objects versus less real. He doesn't want to get into that. He wants to say the dreamed
You're right.
experience has a different relationship to other experiences than the non-dream.
The only thing I want to change, the way you talked about that earlier, Wes, is that he flattens the various degrees of existence. And I understand that he doesn't want to say that, for instance, appearances have less reality than the things driving them, or that God has the ultimate reality, or the forms have the ultimate reality. And of course, in that sense, he wants to flatten them. But I think he could be open to, he wants to get rid of hierarchies like this, but he could be open to a multiplicity as revealed through actual experiences. So you might, for practical purposes, say the dream table is not real and the table in the room is real because
yeah.
just for a practical, yeah.
But yeah, you're not using the words in a metaphysical way, you're using them yep. in a functional way. And yeah, so when I'm thinking of flattening, I'm thinking that the mind independence, it's this idea of that there needs to be something mind independent to undergird experience, to make it non-solipsistic or to say why we can have agreements or disagreements about things. And somehow that, whatever's doing that, can't be in the third dimension. It has to get sucked into the picture, the two-dimensional appearance picture. That's the flattening I'm talking about. So I don't know how you do that exactly. I've never understood about pragmatism, but there's one allusion in this to this mind-independent existence. But the point is, it's not that there are these real things on some other plane that govern the appearances. There are just these sequences and there are regularities in those sequences, and that is somehow the real. Do you see what I'm saying? Instead of it being outside and pushing on and,
yes.
and swirling up reality and keeping it orderly,
yep.
the orderliness just is the real somehow. So yeah.
Yeah. Isn't it, you're using your three-dimensional, two-dimensional thing, isn't it the world at large you'd call three-dimensional? It's all these events and our experience, which is the only way in which we get any purchase on it at all, slices through it, maybe only two-dimensionally, that we slice through it and we interact with it. And all that we can grasp about the world outside of ourselves does come through us. But it's not that we deny that it exists, and it's not that we're not trying to figure it out. But inevitably, it comes through that we can't have any experience of it without it going through us, through that two-dimensional plane. The only things that we can learn about the world are through that two-dimensional plane, the things that we can intersect into it.
Right. That's definitely one of the huge appeals of pragmatism, I think, because it really does do the things he says, which is it does away with these problems of the relationship of this external real to the appearance and subject-object and things like that. But you have to assume it creates new problems following his model. But every good theory creates new problems.
Right. And I'm a little torn in the way that you're describing it, because you're kind of describing it, like a neo-Kantianism of cutting off, the way Dylan was saying it, that we have to get it sort of through ourselves.
Well, except that, a Kantian would need the thing in itself to anchor everything.
Right. So that's why I said a neo-Kantian, a Hegelian or something, which again, he's writing.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
By okay. somebody that just cuts off the thing in itself part, but still identifies it. And apparently this is what Dewey did in his earlier writing explicitly, is he said, there is no problem of the division between mind and things in the world, because the world is sort of defined as that which the world of mind, something like that.
Right. And you can see why this book would be criticized for being crypto-idealism.
He thinks that he had a turn after that and decided that the idealist talk just didn't add anything to the picture, that Dewey was too entranced by actual science, and he thought that we could go to more of a naive realist standpoint, and so that he could really say, it would be very surprising to me if, according to Dewey's analysis, he would have to be committed to saying the dream table is just as real as the table in the world. Because that's an ordinary language well, he says bad things to say about common sense, but it's something that is upheld by scientific inquiry. He wants to retain the terms like reality and even metaphysics. It's not that he's avoiding talk of metaphysics and saying, we're just going to stay within what Kant would call the phenomenal realm. He's saying, well, because the phenomenal realm is all there is, we can just say, this is metaphysically real without any qualification.
That is kind of what Hegel said.
Yeah.
Except that he just doesn't use the word everything is spirit, everything is idea. I mean, there must be consequences to that. I'd have to think about, well, what are the consequences of his just saying, okay, these are real things, and he's not going to call it idea, and he's not going to call it matter.
He's not going to call it spirit.
It's just things. Yeah. What's different about that than one of these other choices?
I heard Dewey criticizing Hegel when he was criticizing a little bit of the partisans of flux, the partisans of changing, that Hegel would make the dialectic this one fixed relation out of which, you know, once you transcended that, you would be hunky-dory, you would know everything. That's what the world really was. And Dewey seems to want to basically at least say that's going too far, and it's purging its own activity. It's putting an end to the activity of thinking and thought.
Well, by saying that flux is constant, you're reifying something itself.
Yeah, but also remember what his big objections. The big problem with idealism and materialism is it's just they're bad solutions to the subject-object problem, and they don't get rid of it. They don't get rid of the subject-object distinction, and they don't get rid of the appearance-reality distinction. And that's pretty clear in the case of materialism, but a Berkeleyan idealist and a Hegelian, their whole point was to get rid of that distinction in some sense too. Although for Berkeley, it ends up being, you know, you get a subject-object thing because you get God's mind versus our minds. And so arguably, and I just haven't thought about it, there's some sense in which idealism still has the problems that Dewey seems to imply they do, which is the subject-object thing, appearance reality.
Well, he had a nice condemnation of Berkeley. It's page 140. I'll just start reading at the beginning. If we say rational knowledge is a genuine article, then true reality becomes the reality of materialism or of logical realism or of objective idealism, according to training and temperament. To follow the clues of experience is to see that the so-called sensible world is a world of immediate beginnings and endings, not at all an affair of cases of knowledge, but a succession of qualitative events, while the so-called conceptual order is recognized to be the proper object of science, since it constitutes the scheme of the constant relationships by means of which spare, scattered, and causal events are bound together into a connected history. These emergent, immediate events remain the beginning and end of knowledge. But since their occurrence is one with their being sensibly, affectionately, and appreciatively had, they are not themselves things known.
Yeah.
That the qualities and characters of these, so this is materialism first, this is not Berkeley yet, that the qualities and characters of these immediate apparitions are tremendously modified when they are linked together by, quote, physical objects, that is by means of the mathematical, mechanical objects of physics, is a fact of the same nature that a steel watch spring is a modification of crude iron ore.
He's giving his own view here.
Okay.
The immediate events are the beginning, the bookends of knowledge, the knowledges of the relations. And this is where he says they are had, but they're not known. The knowledge is directed towards the causal sequence.
Oh, okay. Yes.
The having is directed towards the immediacy. Yeah.
Yeah. The objects of physics subsist precisely in order to bring about this transformation, to change, that is, causal endings into fulfillments and conclusions into ordered series with the development of meaning therein involved.
All right, so the part where he starts bashing on Berkeley is after that. Practically all epistemological discussion depends on a sudden and unavowed shift to and fro from the universe of having to the universe of discourse. At the outset, ordinary empirical affairs, chairs, tables, stones, sticks, etc., are called physical objects, which is obviously a term of theoretical interpretation when it's so applied, carrying within itself a complete metaphysical commitment. Then physical objects are defined as the objects of physics, which is, I suppose, the only correct mode of designation. But such objects are clearly very different things from that of the plants, lamps, thunder, and lightning, rocks, etc. that were first called physical objects. So another transformation, phantasmagoria, in the tableau is staged. The original physical things, ordinary empirical objects, not being the objects of physics, are not physical at all, but mental. Then comes the grand dissolving climax in which objects of physics are shown as themselves hanging from empirical objects now dressed up as mental, and hence as themselves mental.
I thought he was giving the transition from Locke to Kant here.
Okay, I thought he was going to Berkeley.
Because what happens is you start out, these are the physical objects, and then science comes along, and oh, it's not that this thing is actually blue, it's electromagnetic radiation, and it's only solidity, and you know, it's the spatiotemporal that's real, and then blue is a secondary quality that's to be explained away. And then what happens is when you reflect on that in the Kantian step, space and time get sucked into that too, into that hole of the mental. So that's where all objects of physics are shown in themselves hanging from empirical objects now dressed up as mental, and hence themselves are mentals. The spatio-temporal, what used to be primary qualities, becomes mental as well. But I think your reading works as well.
Yeah, I think you're sticking a little too much Kantianism in that particular sentence, that the difference between that science is saying it's not chair, it's chair and then your perception of chair. So what chair is something scientific, really. And so what you must be perceiving is only your perception of chair.
No, it's the idea that the chairs are made of atoms or something like that. The scientific step is to say the chair isn't really the phenomenal chair. It's the atoms that make it up.
And so that's what makes the first step happen, which is to say, since you don't perceive atoms directly, what you must be perceiving is not the real chair. You must be perceiving something in your mind.
Right.
But then somebody says, well, why do you think that the thing in your mind refers to thing atoms out there? The only reason you think that they're atoms, the only reason you came to that conclusion is because of your experiences, because of these things that are mental. And so Berkeley then takes the next step to say, oh, well, then the chair itself, the atoms itself, they are, if they're derived only from mental things, according to our epistemology of the matter, is they are all mental. So Berkeleyan idealism becomes a crazy reductio ad absurdum to this whole distinction in the first place. Everything now being mental and the term having lost its original contrasting or differential meaning, a new and different series of transformation scenes is exhibited. Immediate empirical things are resolved into hard sensory data, which are called the genuine physical things, while the objects of physical science are treated as our logical constructions.
Turnip, anyone?
All that remains to constitute... yes. All that remains to constitute mental existence is images and feelings.
Yeah, it's a good summary of all the steps.
Do you agree with me that this is a sequence of steps that he's rejecting because they start with a mistake?
Well, yeah, he's saying this is all a mistake. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay. So, but right after that on page 142 is when he actually gets to what the features of physical objects actually are.
Yeah.
According to his theory, that we have to consider calling it something physical as opposed to mental is picking out a functional characteristic of
yes.
it. So he gives four characteristics of what physical objects. Well, immediate things come and go, but physical objects seem to stick around. Spatiotemporal orders capable of mathematical formulation are, by contrast, constant. So that's the first thing. The second one is that they...
Substitutions.
The second character of objects, yes. I had a little trouble understanding what this meant. The possibility of regulating the occurrence of any event depends upon the possibility of instituting substitutions. By means of the latter, a thing which is within grasp is used to stand for another thing which is not immediately had or which is beyond control.
So, for instance, your readings on a dial in the physics lab is substitution for the particles that you're measuring or something like that.
Because at the end of that, he says, these become amenable to transformations in virtue of reciprocal substitutions. Is a system of exchange and mutual conversion carried to its limit?
This is where some examples would have been nice. Pretty much
yeah.
through the whole book.
Because I thought he was just talking about what makes something a physical object, not what makes something an atom.
He's talking about the objects of physics.
Yeah.
Not physical objects.
Yes. Objects of
those
science.
Those are two different
scientific
things.
Objects.
What we call physical objects are the objects of immediate experience. The objects of physics are the objects of knowledge instead of immediate experience mm-hmm. and are not metaphysically real.
But isn't what I was reading at the beginning of this whole... eventual getting to Berkeley was to say, at the outset, ordinary empirical affairs, chairs, tables, stones, sticks, etc., are called physical objects, which is obviously a term of theoretical interpretation when it is so applied, carrying with itself a complete metaphysical commitment.
Yeah, that's...
That's part of the mistake? That's not his view.
Yeah. I think at this point, you're already... The physical objects are set up as opposed to mind or something like that. That's why they're physical.
But... couldn't you talk about the table as an object of physics? Or can you only talk about subatomic particle or, you know, atoms as objects of physics?
Seems like you certainly could.
Well, then, no, but that's the second step. Then physical objects are defined as the objects of physics. So that's step one is just, these are physical objects and here's my mind and those two things are different. So the error there is already this subject-object relation. The physical part, I think, is meant to imply the... Then you say, oh... The physical objects are actually, they're made up of atoms and light bounces on them. And then, so you define the subject-object relationship in a new way.
Well, so at the beginning of the chapter, of that paragraph, Mark, of the four objects of science, he's getting into the part that his point of view. If objects which are colored, sonorous, tactile, gustatory, loved, hated, enjoyed, admired, which are attractive and repulsive, exciting, indifferent, and depressive in all their infinitely numerous modes are beginnings and endings of complex natural affairs, and if physical objects, defined as objects of physical science, are constituted by a mathematical mechanical order, then physical objects, instead of involving us in the predicament of having to choose between opposing claimants to reality, have precisely the characters which they should have in order to serve effectively as means for securing and avoiding immediate objects.
What page are you reading on?
141 to 142.
Yep. And then he goes into the four of these characters, maybe noted, the characters of the objects of science.
So that says to me that the table... On the one hand, it's wooden and pretty looking, and it has all the associations and potentialities. I could even hate this table, and it would be objectively hateful, according to, you know, there's an occurrence of hating the table in the room. Dewey would be okay with that. He doesn't want to say the hate is merely in my mind. But when physics takes a look at that same table, then, of course, it's only going to consider certain parts of it. So if we call it, it sort of depends how we identify the table. What descriptive term we're using. If we're saying the table, it's still the very same table. And if we know physics, we could look at the table and that will be part of our gestalt of tableness, is the fact that it's made of atoms.
Well, he's saying that that's our transition to what's just effective, this perceptual part of experience as the table, to its being a sign, right? So that's when we, in the same way that the tool becomes not just an aesthetic object, but a something that's predictive in a way, or is a sign. Or,
yes, in a way that dream table is not.
That's where the mathematical mechanical order comes in. So instead of the atoms underlying the real underlying reality of a phenomena, they're a way of describing sequences within experience, and they don't make us, this predicament he talks about, they don't make us choose, am I going to choose the phenomenal table as real or the atoms as the real thing? We don't have to worry about that, because when he says they have all the characters that they should have in order to serve effectively as means for securing and avoiding immediate objects, this idea of using the mathematical mechanical order, we can regulate things such that we get the end results that we want. So what's a good example?
So they're stable. They admit substitutions. We didn't know what that meant. He says that the other two are the importance of elements. You know, if you care about how well the table is going to hold things up, then you care about its brittleness or something, which has to do with how the different particles of it stick together. You want to know, is the table going to stand up to the weight that I'm going to put on it? And then also the central position of laws and relations. So just the causal properties of the table.
Yeah. So we get three kind of things from him. The objects of physics, unlike immediate objects, are constant. They allow substitution, and then they allow things to be treated as made of parts.
Relatively constant. Relatively stable.
Yes. And the relations form laws.
So the laws themselves, though, are constant. The table is relatively constant, but the mathematical, mechanical laws are themselves constant. I mean, they may be revised, but as they stand, they're constants. You know, these are the wave equations.
Yes.
This is the inverse square law.
That law itself doesn't change, but it may be revised. So insofar as it gets revised or thrown out, then you would say that it's changing. But it really is a different kind of change than physical objects themselves.
So yeah, so then on 144, that's where he gets to saying he uses this term dialectical entities.
Mm-hmm.
So would that have instrumental character but are not metaphysical ultimates?
Yeah. He says the instrumental nature of objects of knowledge accounts for the central position of laws and relations. These are the formulations of the regularities upon which intellectual and other regulation of things as immediate apparitions depends. Variability of elements in mathematical science is spacious. Elements vary independently of one another, but not independently in relation to others, the relation or law being constancy among variations. So this is just your point, Wes, that the laws themselves aren't changing.
Where were you just reading?
146 or so.
Yeah. So later on in that paragraph, it is thus only pro forma that the variable is variable. It is not variable in the sense in which unique individualized existences are variable.
Yeah, he's talking about the way in which this the substitution part doesn't mean that the laws aren't constant.
Yeah. And then he points a little bit to one of the challenges here, the instrumental nature of the relation of elements and this abrogation of individuality merely means a temporary neglect, an abstracted gaze, in behalf of attending to conditions under which individualities present themselves. Convert the objects of knowledge into real things by themselves, and individuals become anomalous or unreal. They are not individualized for science, but are instances, cases, specimens of some generical relation or law. So this is one of the activities of science, to fix these things in an abstracted gaze and hold them as to be fixed entities. And this is one of the dangers in science when you neglect the fact that the things you're looking at as actual phenomena are not fixed. So that, you know, unless you're an experimentalist who really hopes and prays that when you go and turn on your machine that you'll see something you've never seen before, and that doesn't make any sense. If everything is always fixed, then to the extent that your abstracted gaze corresponds directly with reality, then exactly. You would no longer have live, real, existing objects.
So if it's all just atoms, or the extent to which these universal laws subsume individuals, the individuality is eliminated, you know, for the sake of a law of physics. It's not this planet. It's all planets that are subjected to gravity in this way. But yeah, if we see those relations as instrumental, then the abstraction is temporary neglect. But it's when we reify the physics of it, then individuals become the unreal things. The phenomenal individual is not real. The table is not real, but the atoms are, things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he wants to remind us, 148, I have a quote, "Timeless laws taken by themselves, like all universals, express dialectic intent, not any matter of fact existence." You know, there was a reason that you came up with that law, that descriptive regularity, because you wanted to do something in the broad sense. It's not an existent. So this all just shows that my equation earlier in the discussion with tools like the telescope and natural laws that we use to describe the motion of the planets, that those are not the same thing. He's not equating those. I was wrong.
But I think dialectical intent, doesn't that just mean that it's kind of an, if I do this, then this will happen? Again, it's a broader than I want to make a chair or I want to blow up something, so I'm going to learn how to split the atom.
If I look at this part of the sky, I expect to see this.
Yeah, the intent part is about this expectation thing where we think that doing something, which becomes experimentation, but doing something is going to produce a certain result.
If I drop a grapefruit off of the high building, it will splat.
That was my high school science project.
Grapefruits?
No. I used to have nightmares about what they call it? Science projects?
Science Olympiad.
Science fairs?
Science fairs. Oh, my God. Yeah. I used to have nightmares.
I was terrible at those. My first science fair thing in seventh grade was trying to show that fish move less when they're in the dark. And because I knew that fish were colorblind, I thought that I could take a green light into a closet with some fish. And because they're colorblind, they wouldn't be able to see at all. They would think it was completely dark. So my whole experiment was based on a misunderstanding of what colorblind means.
That's awesome.
Because, you know, with the red light, you could do photographs. And so it's like there's actually no light there. I thought that was the same with any color. So I didn't get that. And then in eighth grade, I made a windmill and glued a bicycle counter and was trying to change the angle of the windmill blades to see if it would move faster. Like, just really prove a very fundamental thing about windmills, but I couldn't actually get it to work. I couldn't get the glue. The glue would not stick so that the counter would actually turn. So I merely falsified my results.
And this is why, unlike Dylan, we didn't become scientists.
Terrible. And what do we have to say about that? I learned by doing. It was a hands-on thing.
Yeah, you experimentally proved your ignorance of colorblindness.
I feel the end coming.
Yeah, I'm exhausted.
Well, I think we hit most of the high points. We didn't talk about exactly how central festivity is in nature, but that was probably my favorite part of the reading. The beginning is of all the chapters.
Yeah, before he starts repeating himself.
Yes, chapter one was a little dry. When he got to transubstantiation.
Oh, yeah, right.
I need to look up this quote.
In your edition, the quote would start at the very bottom of 28 and go to the very first two lines of 29.
Yeah.
You say, permanence, real essence, totality, order, unity, rationality, the unum, verum, et bonum of the classic tradition are eulogistic predicates. When we find such terms used to describe the foundations and proper conclusions of a philosophic system, there is ground for suspecting that an artificial simplification of existence has been performed. Reflection, determining preference for an eventual good, has dialectically wrought a miracle of transubstantiation.
Yes, that's the first place in the book where I smiled and said, this is not so bad. This is, it just seemed dry before that, but I really like that quote. I really like the beginnings of chapter 2 when he starts talking about how dangerous the world is and how fear is real, and the beginning of chapter 3 when he talks about how central consummatory experiences, what he calls, we haven't used that word yet, why he thinks these aesthetic things are final. It's not that we're just always doing things for the sake of survival, like a strict Darwinian would say. It's that we're sort of always bursting the pursuit of primary experience of aesthetic glory, of pleasure, and the press of necessity that drives us to labor always go hand in hand. He says, while homes are still hovels, temples and palaces are embellished. Luxuries prevail over necessities except where necessities can be feastily celebrated. Men make a game of their fishing and hunting and turn to the periodic and disciplinary labor of agriculture only when inferiors, women and slaves, cannot be had to do the work. Useful labor is, whenever possible, transformed by ceremonial and ritual accompaniments, subordinated to art that yields immediate enjoyment. Otherwise, it is attended to under the compulsion of circumstances during abbreviated surrenders of leisure.
Yes.
I just like this whole non-functional, you know, really surprising for somebody who seems to be following Darwin, this cultural insight that seems very Nietzschean to me.
Yeah, just this idea that imagination imbues work with consummatory satisfaction and gives it the structure of play, while labor in turn gives back to play, he says it gives it a plot, it sort of structures play. So the dynamic between those two, when I said it was packed with insight, that's one of the things that...
Yeah. I mean, he's using this all to set up the idea that we make mistakes, philosophical mistakes based on this, but it's very insightful in itself. Going back and taking notes on it the second time, I didn't mind some of the stuff before. It's just that, you know, the preface, which kind of outlines the whole thing and outlines the chapters, is really hard to understand without being immersed in the chapters. These ideas are not easy to summarize, even though it seems like you could just state them in one sentence. To use his terminology and make it understandable just doesn't work so well. So the preface was hard, and that kind of bled over into the chapter 1 on philosophic method, where, of course, I got the main point that experience is not a screen over nature, but there's nothing new here. You know, we had it in Whitehead, we had it in Merleau-Ponty, we've had it in probably Hegel and William James and everybody else. Like, so if that was all there was to this book, I was just really going to be irritated. So I'm glad he had, I think did a really good job, where I would criticize Nietzsche, even though I like when he, instead of analyzing their philosophies, analyzing the motives behind the philosophies, he does so in such a sort of quick way that to have somebody like Dewey here systematically go through and talk about cultural mistakes as coming out of our functional need for survival and desire for decking things out for pleasure in this way. If he'd actually added more real examples, it would have even been better. But still, there was enough for me to chew on, so I enjoyed that much.
I really love Dewey, to tell you the truth, despite my anti-pragmatist leanings. And it's a really attractive theory of things. I mean, the only part I don't really buy is sort of the psychological explanations of why its metaphysics was determined by this propensity for the stable and it's safer. And then this creates this subject-object problem. I see the origins of philosophy having to do with pluralism, which is to say the pluralism of ancient Athens, for instance, in which there was a question of what the good was and people disagreed about it. And the basic question was whether the good is getting what I want or is it being a good person, that kind of question, being virtuous. And it's that disagreement, it's the normative problem that leads to knowledge being a problem. Epistemology, it's pretty clear from Plato, grows out of the normative problem of disagreeing about what is good, which then in turn brings about the problem of the nature of the world. Because for metaphysics, the real question is, what is it about the world that is knowable by us? So I think there are real problems philosophy is actually addressing and concerned with, and it's not to be psychoanalyzed away by talk of the precarious and the stable and things like that.
Well, Wes, you've convinced me that I've read so many of these genealogical accounts. You know, we just had one with Ava Brand. We've had other ones with the Birth of Tragedy, that I don't even read them anymore thinking, is this actually historically right, how it worked? I only read it for, like, does this illuminate in an interesting way the point he wants to make about what's wrong with philosophy now? So.
Yeah, and I think they can be psychologically quite accurate. And the same thing goes with psychoanalysis. You know, even though it's an interest of mine, the idea of psychoanalyzing away explanations is just an ad hominem. It doesn't matter if the motive was the precarious and the stable. You know, it could also be that there were real interesting problems that philosophers were concerned with. So I think Dewey, in a way, is actually right to some extent psychologically, but that doesn't change the fact that philosophy is concerned with real and interesting problems. But maybe I'll change my mind once I understand pragmatism better, which, by the way, I think, again, is enormously appealing, but I don't understand the way you get around the need for mind independence and how you suck that into your two-dimensional picture. I've never gotten it. And so it seems to me like it devolves into man is the measure of all things or some sort of relativism or idealism. But if I understood it better, and I think, unfortunately, Dewey doesn't give the kinds of examples or he doesn't tackle this particular problem head on of trying to explain to you how it's not relativistic. And I'm sure there's stuff out there that does, but that's what I want explained to me.
The problem is you're just not deep enough, Wes. That's all.
Oh, man.
You just don't get it. What do you think, Dylan?
I loved it. I maybe surprisingly haven't read Dewey before. And from the very beginning, from the preface, he was just making a lot of sense. I found the first chapter dry, similar to what Mark said. I thought it picked up a lot afterwards. I thought that his characterization of science as a process of figuring things out, in which things are held to be true, but in the end, revisable, just seemed exactly right. And it seemed exactly the way in which, if we're to be figuring out things in the world in a live way, that's exactly right, including our arguments about what amounts to good living. It would be interesting to read him later to see about these pluralistic problems that maybe don't admit of the same kind of solution, in that they may be humanly dependent in a way that there may not be a single solution to it. But in terms of his characterization of scientific work and even philosophical activity as being an active process of unearthing and critiquing and reflecting, just resonated with me deeply. I had two quotes that I wanted to end on. One was just at the very beginning of chapter 3. It was one of my, there's ways in which he's kind of funny. He says, "The history of man shows, however, that man takes his enjoyment neat and at as short range as possible." When he's talking about the primacy of festivities. I just enjoyed that. At the end of like the last 5 pages of Nature, Means, and Knowledge, he says, "In the practice of science, knowledge is an affair of making sure, not of grasping antecedently given sureties. What is already known, what is accepted as truth, is of immense importance. Inquiry could not proceed a step without it, but it is held subject to use and is at the mercy of the discoveries which make it possible. It has to be adjusted to the latter and not the latter to it. When things are defined as instruments, their value and validity reside in what proceeds from them. Consequences, not antecedents, supply meaning and verity. Truths already possessed may have practical or moral certainty, but logically never lose a hypothetical quality. They are true if certain other things eventually present themselves, and when these latter things occur, they in turn suggest further possibilities. The operation of doubt, inquiry, finding recurs. Although science is concerned in practice with the contingent, its method is that of making hypotheses which are then tried out in actual experimental change of physical conditions. Its traditional formulation persists in terms of necessary and fixed objects. Hence all kinds of incoherences occur. The more stubbornly the traditional formulation is clung to, the more serious become these inconsistencies." I mean, just that paragraph right there. He understands how science works, straight up.
Right. And it's just these bastard philosophers that don't understand science that just screw everything up.
Yeah, I didn't like the parts where he's shitting all over philosophy. Forgot to say that. Dylan seems perfectly okay with.
Well, what we did not read the last chapter is him talking about philosophy. Well, you know, what does this mean for philosophy? So, though I have to say, you know, one of the things I was sympathetic with is the way in which, for him, science is philosophy, right? What I just read about science, he would say is true of philosophy.
Naturalistic philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rightly conceived, but not all the bullshit that I'm interested in.
So that all that bullshit, I think how we sort that out, and maybe I don't know his work enough to know if he gets into political philosophy.
We got hints of it in here that one of the abstractions was forgetting that man is fundamentally a social animal,
yep,
a political animal, and talks about the social contract at one point in here as being a disastrous mistake. And you know, it's just one of the many histories that he gives in one of these chapters, talking about the rise of individualism, about how all these steps, you know, they had positive effects. They enabled science to go forward. In this case, it was by recognizing individual subjectivity, like by pointing that out as its own thing. Like that was a big deal in terms of, and this is what philosophy is about. It's about being critical about our prejudices. Yep. That if you don't have the distinction between mind and object, then you can't get the idea that, well, maybe you're only perceiving things the way you do because of prejudices from your society or from your psychology. So it really is important to peel those things apart analytically as a corrective. And that's ultimately what philosophy is trying to do. It's just that when you peel it apart too far, you forget that the peeling happened. You forget that you're dealing with an abstraction, yep, and think that the primal subjectivity is the thing that you start with, you know, or the only thing you can be sure of, like Descartes. Then you create these insoluble problems. And so this is his issue, you know, in general, when he's going off against philosophy, it's because of this hypostasization of one thing or another. So he really is, like many pragmatists, and trying to sweep under the rug a lot of the classical philosophical problems by saying they don't have a leg to stand on. They're conceptually confused from the start.
And I am completely in favor of reification, of reifying atoms and saying, those are real. Blue is in my head. Electromagnetic radiation bounces off.
I'm in favor of reifying them and actually making them king. not just making them things.
That atoms are king.
Well, next time, we're going to go back to modern analytic philosophy with Hilary Putnam. Some stuff about twin Earths, in other words, about modality, just like we had in the Saul Kripke episode. The Meaning of Meaning is one essay. Is Semantics Possible? And It Ain't Necessarily So.
And I get the feeling that Dewey would not have approved of any of them. Although Putnam denies being a pragmatist, but he is influenced by pragmatism.
Yeah. Right. The Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy said Hilary Putnam, in particular, named Dewey as having some significant influence on him.
He rejects the pragmatist definition of truth. And
well, actually, it's funny, Dewey himself later didn't want to follow James in redefining truth. He did this in his early career, but later he just said, we're just going to stop using the word truth and use warranted assertion.
Well, yeah.
That's what I mean.
And Richard Rorty has picked up on that to pernicious effect, I think. But anyway,
hey, we're supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included Michalin Lutji, Jeff Hedge, Michael Zanett, Jeff Murphy, Ryan Fitzgerald, Bryce Pulley, Colin Gorey, Sandra York, Amy Omana, Michael Guido, Lindsay Bunt, Stephen Tulloch, David Smith, Dominic Harris, Zekun Hu, Laura Davis Channon, Matt Sanza, Greg Vogelsberger, Sebastian Sarti, Allison Jones, David Stanton, and Jeannie Carey. Thanks also to the smaller donors, including those who are newly or on a continued basis signed up for our $5 a month citizen site, which you should do. If you're too cheap for that, just go play around in our Facebook group. You could participate that way. You could read the blog. You could subscribe to a near daily email from us about various things. You could follow us on Twitter. You could reify something and dedicate it to us. I don't know.
And we want to remind you, this podcast has been brought to you by Zevia, the zero-calorie, naturally sweetened soda that is clearly different. No sugar, no calories, and non-GMO Project Verified make this a cleaner, healthier soda option. Zevia is available in 15 delicious flavors like cream soda, black cherry, cola, ginger ale, and tonic water. always zero calories, and they make excellent mixers. Go to Zevia.com/podcast because Zevia is giving away thousands of free six-packs. Seriously, thousands have been won, and who knows, you could come home to a surprise soda on your doorstep. Random but delicious. Head to Zevia.com/podcast to get yours. That's Zevia.com/podcast.
All right. Thanks, guys. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
I love you, baby, but you don't know. Just hard to tell, lady, but it's been showing.